Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Weisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
All right. From Popular Science, a scandal has rocked international stone skipping contest. That's right. A very real thing. So earlier in this year, over 2,000 people traveled from 27 countries to the car-free island of Easdale off Scotland's western coast for the annual World Stone Skimming Competition. Held nearly every year since 1983, the contest invites participants to test their skills in, quote, the world's first dedicated stone skimming arena, which is a slate quarry that flooded in 1881. The rules are clear. Contestants must use unaltered stones selected from among the island's naturally occurring slate. Then the judges use a measuring device called the Ring of Truth, which is a metal apparatus that makes sure that none of the rocks are larger than 3 inches wide. Participants get 3 skim attempts, each of which must bounce at least twice in order to qualify towards their cumulative score. But according to Toss Master Kyle Matthews, judges soon heard rumors and murmurings of some stone doctoring. These stone selections in question appeared to have been ground into more circular shapes in the hopes of improving their bounce potential. Now, speaking with Popular Science, Matthews, who has served as a competition organizer for the past 3 years, says the discovery was a first for the championship, which also serves as a charity event for local organizations. Quote, the would-be cheaters admitted to the scheme by a show of hands and apologized for their misdeeds after the judges raised their suspicions. But the nefarious deeds couldn't keep one John Jennings from winning. Now, professional stone skimmers like John Jennings spend countless hours practicing strategies. And this year, this Kentucky resident made history.
I mean, professional's a stretch, though, right? Like, he's not getting paid every year to...
He won a championship for
it. Yeah, but if money's going to charity, is there a prize pot or no?
That's a really capitalistic question.
You can't call yourself a professional if you're not getting paid.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great question that I hope we resolve before I die.
I don't think we will.
Well, you know, never say never, because John Jennings didn't think he was going to win, but this was only his second visit to the championship. He got a cumulative score of 580.7 feet. He is the official world champion. He's also the first American to ever win the showdown, as well as the contest's new record holder for distance. So at least bragging rights. Hopefully that can translate to currency sometime soon.
Right.
Now, Jennings says that everything he knows about the science of stone skipping comes from Kurt Steiner, who has held the Guinness World Record for most skips on a single throw. Any guesses?
20.
26.
88.
What?
Crap.
Yeah. Over the years, he has become a dear friend of mine and my family, Jennings explains. He talks about how the rock needs to hit the water at a 15 to 20 degree angle. The gyroscopic spin is what propels the stone through the water. And based on Jennings' own strategies, it also sounds like the artificially rounded stones never stood a chance. Quote, me personally, I like more square stones with flat edges. The flat edges seem to slice through the water, where rounder edges seem to gallop through the water.
I'm wondering if they then scuba dive off the coast to go find those choice rocks again and bring them back and put them in a special hiding spot for next year.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out how you would possibly count 88 skips. I mean, I guess if we have drone technology now, you could get overhead. But I mean, there's a distance involved. How are you going to count them at that distance?
Well, the Guinness World Records, they're very serious in how they record all of this. So I would assume they would have several people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe sound is involved in that verification, too.
Mm, that's true.
They consult with the mermaids under the water to see what they saw. All right, next link.
Next link.
This article is titled Misunderstood Malthus, and this is the English thinker whose name is synonymous with doom and gloom, which has lessons for us today. So no one uses Malthusian as a compliment. Since 1798, when the economist and cleric Thomas Malthus first published an essay on the principles of population, the Malthusian position, the idea that humans are subject to natural limits, has been vilified and scorned. Today, the term is lobbed at anyone who dares question the optimism of infinite progress.
Mm.
Unfortunately, almost everything most people think they know about Malthus is wrong. The story goes like this. Once upon a time, an English country parson came up with the idea that population increases at a geometrical rate, while food production increases at an arithmetical rate. That is, population doubles every 25 years, while crop yields increase much more slowly. Over time, such divergence must lead to catastrophe. But Malthus identified two factors that reduced reproduction and held off disaster: moral codes, or what he called preventative checks, and positive checks, such as extreme poverty, pollution, war, disease, and misogyny. Positive checks.
Right.
In the all-too-common caricature, Malthus was a narrow-minded clergyman who was bad at math and thought the only solution to hunger was to keep poor people poor so they had fewer babies. And of course, nowadays, we know that that's not how that works.
Right.
So understanding Malthus in a broader context reveals a very different character. As the author Roy Scranton discusses in his 2025 book Impasse, Malthus was an innovative and insightful thinker. Not only was he one of the founding figures of environmental economics, but he also turned out to be a prophetic critic of the belief that history tends toward human improvement. And on the topic of progress, Malthus did know what he was talking about. He was raised and educated by dissenters, progressivist English Protestants who advocated the separation of church and state. He was taught by the radical abolitionist Gilbert Wakefield, and his father was a friend and admirer of the Enlightenment philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, whose ideas helped inspire the French Revolution. Going into the clergy was a common choice for educated young men of middling means, and Malthus was able to secure a parsonage in Watton, Surrey. His essay on the principle of population was shaped by his theological views, but it's also a very empirical work, and became more so as he revised it in later editions. His argument about geometrical and arithmetical growth rates, for example, was based on the rapid population growth witnessed in the American colonies. But why was Malthus talking about population in the first place? As he himself explains, his essay was inspired by an argument with a friend about the journalist and novelist William Godwin, best known today as the father of Mary Shelley, author of Frankenstein. Godwin argued that all social problems could be eliminated by reason's proper application. He advocated abolishing marriage, redistributing property, and eliminating government. What's more, he asserted that progress led inevitably to a utopian world where humans will no longer have to reproduce because we'll be immortal. Which, utopians, right?
Yeah.
So Roddenberry thinking, yeah.
Yeah. Such things would come about in due time, Godwin assured his readers, solely through the spread of rational discussion. Yeah, I'll just leave some space for that idea.
Yeah.
From his poverty-stricken parsonage in Watton, Malthus saw things differently. Studying history led Malthus to conclude that societies moved not in an ever-ascending line of progress, but in cycles of expansion and decline. He wasn't saying positive change was impossible, only that it was limited by the laws of nature. An essay on the principles of population was his attempt to ascertain where some of those limits might lie so that policy could respond to social problems effectively rather than exacerbating them by trying to achieve the impossible.
That's not unreasonable.
Yeah, it's really interesting to compare because a lot of the time you'll hear people criticize Malthus as like not understanding the ways in which resources can actually scale if you include tech progress there. But it's also funny because simultaneously, you know, a lot of our society is deeply Malthusian, where you'll hear people talk about, you know, oh, there's too many damn people, it's causing climate change, etc. I mean, you know, indirect causes and effects and all that.
But you're
jazz.
Right. It's like we're kind of, they set up a duality that we have yet to escape from, basically.
Yes.
Well, and it does seem a little bit hopeful in the sense that, like, yes, there is always a crash and a contraction, but you can achieve progress after that. And if you could account for that, you could maybe take more reasonable steps forward in progress instead of this absolute idealism turning into an absolute crash. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was just looking for kind of the levers of the problem, right? He was like, well, let's actually understand what's going on here, because clearly whatever the hell Godwin's on about is not what's actually up. So, as we face an accelerating global ecological crisis, it may be time to revisit the pessimistic idea that we live in a world with limits, and reconsidering what we mean by Malthusian might be a good place to start.
Yeah, I mean, I'm using that word five times this week. That's my new...
Yeah.
It's like, oh, me? I don't know. I'm just a little Malthusian about it. Just so you know.
Are you feeling Asian or Mexican? I don't know. What would Malthus do?
Malthus say about it.
Malthus would say, what do you actually have in your bank account? Should you even be eating out? Honestly,
true.
Not a bad perspective to take.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Next link.
Next link.
This comes from the conversation. There'll be some, yeah, no kidding moments in this, but there's also some interesting stuff. Smell triggers the same brain response as taste does, even if you haven't eaten anything. Yep, we all know that taste isn't just solely controlled by your taste buds. But what's going on there is when we eat something, two processes happen simultaneously. First, the taste buds on your tongue are activated by the food. At the same time, the odors from these foods travel up through the mouth and into the back of the nose, a process called retronasal smelling. The connection between these two processes is extremely powerful, right? Like, just blocking your sense of smell can alter the way you taste foods, and aroma alone can also be perceived as taste. But though this phenomenon is well established, the mechanism behind it has remained unknown. So to conduct their study, each person was given a variety of different beverages to test. These tasted and smelled of different sweet and savory flavors. The tasters then performed a learning task where they had to correctly remember the abstract visual cues each flavor had been assigned. So they were priming them a little bit, but this helped the participants to establish a strong connection between the taste and the smell of each flavor. So next, they scanned each person's brain using an MRI. And during these sessions, they presented their volunteers with drinks that had only one type of sensory input, either taste or smell, but not both. I have no idea how they did that. Right? Wait, how did you get it to not? Okay. Then they used machine learning, my favorite kind of learning, to identify unique patterns in how different areas of the brain responded when it was exposed to sweet or savory taste or sweet or savory aroma. And as expected, they saw the insula, the brain area that is the primary taste hub, showed different responses to sweet and savory taste, but it also showed a pattern of response to both sweet and savory odors. This overlap was even more pronounced when they looked specifically at the insula's disgranular and agranular regions. These regions are involved in the processing perceptual signals from within the body. Since hunger and thirst signals also come from the body, this could suggest that smell is crucial to hunger regulation. And this is, to me, where the big change in private science research and public science research. I know the Frito-Lay company and Pepsi know this information to be true, but they're not sharing it with the rest of everybody. So everybody's house is finding it out for the first time. But there's stuff in here that I know. Like, I had a friend who worked for Disney, and he said that they had pipes from the kitchen that would go out to the front and pipe all the kitchen smells out to the front so that you were just inundated in those.
Right.
Well, I mean, you sell a house, you're supposed to bake some cookies right before people come by, right?
Oh, that's what we're supposed to do?
Okay. Yeah.
So, yeah, they've done rodent research that indicates that food smells encourage eating by activating a subgroup of neurons. Again, I think we know this intuitively. And their study also showed that while responses to taste and odors overlap, The flavor response changed throughout the course of the experiment, becoming less distinct as time went on. So this kind of means that when you're repeatedly exposed to a smell without tasting it, the brain stops associating the two over time.
Huh.
So that's it on this one. Just a private science and public science. Can you guys share a little bit?
Yeah. Don't patent that Disney restaurant technology. Yeah, like, let us all have it.
That's right. Put it out on the internet. That's what it's for, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Next link.
Next link.
All right, I've got a fun one here from Gizmodo about a new bird species that looks cool as hell, but is a warning sign.
Ooh.
And yeah, right off the bat, I'm going to take issue with this headline because I'm sorry, but it does not look cool as hell.
I thought you were going to say it because it's not a warning sign. It definitely is a warning sign. Damn.
Yeah, it's just not that cool of a bird. Like, it's a fine looking bird, but anyway, we'll get into it. What I will say is this bird does have a very cool name. It is a previously never-before-seen hybrid between a classic blue jay and the lesser-known green jay. Thus, they are calling it a Grue Jay, which, wow. If you, like me, played a lot of Zork as a child, you will recognize the Grue as the monster that comes and kills you in the dark. So that part is indeed cool as hell. As for how it looks, well, for those listeners who aren't in America, a blue jay, of course, has a striking blue coloration with a black eye band and black stripes on the tail feathers capped in white. And for those listeners who aren't in Central America, which I do believe is all of you, but I'd love to be proven wrong, a green jay has a vibrant lime green body with a blue and black head that honestly reminds me a little of Juggalo face paint. Like, it's got these really distinct blue and black regions. It's gorgeous. And so you would, of course, think that the offspring of these two beautiful birds must be very pretty as well. But you would be wrong. The Grue Jay is basically entirely blue with a simple black face, but also the blue is not vibrant. It's this sort of muddy brownish blue. Like, the closest I can describe it is it looks like a blue jay that's really down on its luck.
That happens with some parents, too.
I mean, it does. Some parents, yeah. You know, you got two supermodel parents and the kid just isn't. And the reason the Grue Jay has never been documented before is because the natural habitats of the blue jay and the green jay don't historically overlap. And that's why the headline says that the discovery of the Grue Jay is a warning, because researchers are theorizing that the green jay population has been moving further north due to climate change. The blue jays, meanwhile, have been shifting westward across the U.S. to maintain their own preferred climate. And so for now, at least, the two of them seem to be overlapping. Where they both go in the future is still up in the air, but researchers do warn that we can expect to see a lot of new hybrid species in the coming decades, including some we've already seen, like growler bears, which are grizzlies mating with polar bears, and coy wolves, coyotes breeding with wolves. And I'll be honest, I don't mind the cute names. Like, I'm not going to say they make climate change worth it, but...
What about sharks breeding with tornadoes? Is that going to happen?
Right, yeah. I mean, the question is, what's the natural habitat of the tornado? You gotta,
like... Well, I wonder if the Grue Jay has, like, some really spectacular color in, like, ultraviolet that our pathetic little human eyes can't see, but to them are just, like, superstar.
It could be. Maybe I'm thinking about this all wrong. We need to get some UV light on this bird. Like, so far, there's only been one. That being said, they're pretty sure there are lots of them out there. This is just the first one they've noticed and caught.
Right.
I've got a fun Blue Jay fact, because I'm old now. And okay. I just found this out the other day. Blue jays mimic eagles and hawks and things. So we have a hawk that sounds like a drunken seagull in our neighborhood. And the other day I heard it just screaming and I looked up in our tree and it was just a blue jay making that sound. It's like, what?
Well, that's how that blue jay seduced that green jay then. It basically was saying all the right things.
It's a mimic. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, it's the ChatGPT of the bird world.
Right. Next link.
Next link.
This article comes from the BBC. A Banksy work got stolen from a gallery in 36 seconds.
Whoa, I didn't realize Banksy was in galleries. I guess you could cut the wall out. Okay, yeah.
Well, technically this was a print, but I look forward to the movie starring Angelina Jolie and Nick Cage coming soon.
Right.
It was a 270,000-pound print.
That's heavy.
Yeah, it is.
Sorry, I couldn't help myself.
And it was stolen from a central London gallery in just over 30 seconds. So one Larry Fraser, 48, pled guilty to burglary, but one 54-year-old faced trial over the theft, and his name is James Love. Now, Fraser smashed the glass front door of the Grove Gallery, stepped inside, stole a limited edition print belonging to the street artist's series Girl with Balloon, which is like a little girl in a dress. She's holding a balloon. The balloon is in the shape of a heart. Now, prosecutors allege that Mr. Love, who is said to own a large number of love heart-based pictures, which is like the biggest red flag for villain I have ever heard in a newsprint story. He drove to the gallery on the morning of the burglary and helped store the print after it was stolen. And so the prosecution also alleges that Mr. Love was in regular contact with Fraser the day of the theft. So after leaving the gallery, Fraser took the Banksy into a nearby property where he left the artwork. A night watchman at the property described his shock at being pushed aside by two men who entered the building late that day. He had noticed a painting in a toilet, which like a bathroom, which had not been there earlier that evening, and he described it as depicting a, quote, doll flying something like a kite, which, yeah, pretty accurate, right? So he said, after that, when I saw the painting, I then heard some noise on the other side of the front door. Someone was trying to insert a white plastic bit into the door, trying to open the door. The night watchman opened the door to find a white man and a black man. Quote, I was very shocked. They pushed me out of the way. They went inside. I tried to ask them, who are you? He said they went straight to the bathroom, picked up the painting, and left. And the white male was just saying, sorry, sorry, brother. Sorry, sorry.
sorry, mate.
Pretty much.
Wow.
The night watchman said, why'd you come inside? How'd you come inside? They just came and left in a great hurry. They were barely there for 2 to 3 minutes. They picked up and left. The only thing that was said was, sorry. Wow. So, so Mr. British. Love denies burglary, and the trial continues. But I'm sure his lair has all sorts of treasures.
I mean, that nominative determinism could have gone so many ways. He could have been a therapist. He could have been a sex worker. But no, he's got to steal paintings that involve hearts. Yeah. Like, yeah. It's bizarre.
Yeah. He has yet to embrace the gift of his name, but he's really well acquainted with the shadow of it. All right. Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from Popular Mechanics, titled Archaeologists Solve the Mystery of 6,000-Year-Old Dragon Stones. The answer? A cult.
Yay!
Yeah. Which, honestly, when you see really crazy archaeological things that were constructed thousands of years ago, it's usually a religious thing.
It's almost always a cult.
That's fair.
Yeah. So, the ancient highlands of Armenia are home to a perplexing crop of stones, prehistoric monuments carved, cut, and shaped to resemble fish, cowhide, or a distinct mashup of the two. Researchers investigated the dragon stones, also called Vishap Stele, that's S-T-E-L-E, and discovered a deliberate placement pattern around 8,800 feet in elevation, linked with ancient irrigation systems. The presence of larger monuments at high elevations suggests significant cultural motivations likely tied to the ancient water cult, as Vishaps are predominantly located near springs as well as are represented by fish forms. The team dates the early Vishaps to around 4200 to 4000 BCE. Most of the 115 stones range from 3 to 18 feet in length. Some of the heaviest were actually higher up in the mountains rather than towards the bottom, including a 4.3-ton monument at over 9,000 feet of elevation. The authors wrote, "This suggests the builders intentionally dedicated their limited periods of activity in the higher areas to the construction and transport of large monuments that required much manpower, despite the added logistical difficulties, such as providing food and fuel for the workers." In these regards, comparative studies of Vishaps and analogous high-altitude sacred landscapes provide new interpretive perspectives. And, I don't know, I kind of hoped that they would have a more concrete, like, this is what they were trying to do specifically with it, but lugging a 4.3-ton stone up to a 9,900-foot, or I guess 8,800-feet elevation is just kind of crazy.
Well, I mean, it's ancient aliens, that's why. I mean,
and that's also why it wasn't that hard, actually.
Yeah,
they didn't do it.
Well, and it's like, what does our society leave at the top of mountains? We've got dead hikers.
Yep.
We've got helicopter parts that crash.
I mean, 6,000 years from now, they're going to be looking at our massive statues and being like, why did they do this?
Their god was dumb.
Yeah. Next link.
Next link.
Okay, this comes from Vice. I'll try not to editorialize too much on top of this. Engineers are pitching the idea of a crash-proof airplane.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like the old thing of, like, why don't they make the whole plane out of the black box material?
If it can't crash, it's still... Okay, well, right. Yeah, okay.
I didn't make that up. That's an old joke. Uh-huh. Anyway.
Okay. So, first of all, commercial plane travel is already safer than pretty much anything else. But two young engineers believe survival shouldn't rely on statistics. Their answer is a jet that can puff itself into a Michelin man seconds before impact.
I like this.
Yeah, the project called Rebirth is a finalist for the James Dyson Award. Yes, that Dyson of Dyson Vacuum Cleaners. And yes, he does give out an award under his name, which is weird.
I know Bell did it. It's fine. Okay. Like, he's got money, whatever.
Yeah. It's just the Bradley Calhoun Award presented by Bradley Calhoun. I just weird. I'm sorry.
Listen, I'd attend that fundraiser. Okay. I support you.
You're not going to give it to just anyone. That's sort of the idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Two engineers describe it as the, quote, first AI-powered crash survival system. Yay.
All right.
The system watches everything from altitude to engine health to pilot response. If disaster becomes unavoidable below 3,000 feet, airbags explode from all sides under 2 seconds. The fuselage balloons outward until the plane looks like an enormous inflatable bouncy house, and I'll use their terms, barreling through the sky. Then reverse thrusts or gas boosters kick in to slow the fall, while impact absorbing fluids inside the cabin stiffen on cue to protect the passengers from trauma. So for now, the invention exists only on paper and in concept models because it's not feasible.
Right.
Sorry, that was me. So because they say that they could be retrofitted to current fleets or built into new aircraft. And I would like to point out that a fully loaded DC-9, which isn't the biggest of the jets, weighs about 90,000 pounds when it's taking off. And also, you're going from 600 miles an hour to near zero. That G-force, no matter how soft it is still going to...
Maybe that's why they're focusing on it being like, no crashing, though. We're not saying no trauma, just no crashing.
Right.
Yeah, I prefer parachutes.
Yeah, I think I've seen stuff like that as well, where they're like, oh, we'll just eject the central part of the plane that's got all the people in it, and that part can descend separate from all of the fuel and explodey bits.
Which just goes right into the city and...
Right. But that was going to happen anyway. I mean, come on.
Correct. At least 100 people survive.
What we need now is the bouncy house airbags around all of our buildings everywhere. And when we see an impact coming, we all just bloat up.
I feel like there's got to be like a Kool-Aid man thing to this, too.
Well, when the Michelin man comes barreling through your house at 600 miles an hour, we'll make sure it makes a sound effect that goes, oh, yeah, as it's pressing through your shit.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include why English is full of silent letters, sheet music for cats and their lovers, and I lived underwater for 100 days. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on damninteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/damninteristingweek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.